You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 24th, 2019, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Cara Santamaria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, we have a big trip coming up at the end of the year. We finally got our schedule locked in so we could share it with you. It's going to be a lot of fun. We're going to be in Los Angeles on Saturday, November 23rd, and we will be doing one or two events on that day. Saturday, November 23rd in Los Angeles. The details are still being worked out, but save the date there. Then we're heading down to the South Island of New Zealand. We'll be doing a little bit of vacationing in Queenstown, but if there are any locals who want to hook us up with good fun things to do with our family, let us know. And then we'll be going to Christchurch for the New Zealand Skeptical Meeting. That'll be from November 29th to December 1st. And then we'll be going to Melbourne.
Some
of us actually will be stopping off in Wellington on December 2
Welly,
and 3.
Welly, Wellington.
We'll be working there, doing a super secret project we'll be telling you about later. But I don't know. Do you think it might be possible to do a little bit of a meetup when we're in Wellington,
no,
Jay?
Or absolutely not. No.
No, too busy? All right, Jay says no. And then we go to Melbourne. For the Australian Skeptical Conference, that'll be from Friday, December 6th through the 8th. So we will be, of course, the SGU will be there. We'll be doing live shows. We'll be giving talks. We'll be doing private shows. We'll get those ticket sales going soon. And we're going to be fleshing out some other events. If you have any suggestions or interest or whatever, let us know. But that's our big Down Under trip. We haven't been there. It's been 4 years? I think since you've been there.
2014, so, yeah.
2014.
5 years, so, 5 years.
Yeah, it'll be 5 years.
I think I was there last year. No, it was the year before. 2 years for me.
Yeah, so from my desk, Steve, yes, I will be creating those private events on Eventbrite, and we will make sure that we announce it on the show. You know, there'll be links on the website as well, but those are coming soon. The one you have to keep your eye out for is we're going to be at Dragon Con this year. And we will be having a private SGU show, and we're going to do exactly what we did last year. We're going to rent a room in the hotel that we're staying at, and it's great. It's awesome.
It worked out really well.
This hotel is fantastic.
But we could say it's going to be Saturday at 8 p.m.
Saturday at 8 p.m. I will make sure that the Eventbrite listing is up by the time you're hearing this. So, Steve, that URL to the DragonCon 2019 SGU private show is almost exactly what I just said. It's https://// SGU DragonCon 2019. That's all one word. And I'm not spelling out the word 2019. It's 2019.eventbrite.com. So that's SGU DragonCon2019.eventbrite.com.
The soft cover version of our book will be out this fall, so we'll be able to sell it at these events that we're going to. It'll be after DragonCon, but it'll be for the New Zealand and Australia events.
And the book will have some new material in it, I hear.
It will. As soon as I write it, yeah. All right, so we're going to do another entry of our fairly new segment called What Do You Know, where one of us talk about something interesting that we learned recently that we'd like to share with everybody. So, what do you guys know about beryllium?
Like
the element.
The element?
Yes.
I know that
it's an element.
I do know that for the classic Trek episode, Mudd's Women. No, or is it I, Mudd? I, Mudd. They offered a robot body to Uhura, and the body was it titanium beryllium alloy?
Well, that would be a good alloy, titanium beryllium. Do you know what number it is in the periodic table?
I don't know that.
6.66?
52.
Four. This is element number four.
That's so sad. Why don't we know
that? Yeah, that is, right? I know lithium's three.
Three,
right?
Yeah. It's hydrogen, helium, lithium, beryllium.
And then whatever.
Four.
Yeah.
And then, all right, boron,
so beryllium's one.
Steve, carbon, nitrogen,
why are you excited?
Oxygen.
Who cares?
What do you know, Steve?
For whatever, I heard about beryllium. I realized I know very little about it. And so I started reading up on it, and it's a fascinating element. So it's a metal. It's like a steely gray metal, and it has some very interesting and very useful properties. So first, it's lighter than aluminum. It's only two-thirds the weight of aluminum, so it's a very light metal. But it's stiffer. It had like, and hang on, hold it. It's got a greater specific stiffness than steel.
All right, that's a very, very specific term.
That means it's stiffer by weight than steel, right? But an equivalent like volume of steel may be stronger, but by weight it is stiffer. So that means it's great for structural uses, right? So if you want to build
stiff.
Yeah, it's light and stiff. It's perfect for aerospace, right? It also has an extremely high melting point, 1,287 degrees Celsius. That's like higher than all of the other, you know, solid metals.
So it can withstand certain things in life.
Yeah, so it's used in like nuclear reactors. It also is non-magnetic. So if you need it to, you know, if you being ferromagnetic is a problem, it's good for applications where you want non-magnetic material. It is very conductive of both heat and electricity. And the one downside to it that limits its utility is that it's very toxic.
Okay.
Hey.
Yeah, it's a very toxic element. So you can't
eat it.
Yeah, it tastes very sweet. In fact,
that's dangerous.
The original name for the element was glucinium, as in glucose, as in sweetness. But then it was named after beryllos, which is the Greek name for the mineral beryl, which is the ore, one of the ores of beryllium. It's also, beryllium is something you would find in precious gems like emerald. Beryl gives it its green color. It's an incredibly essential element for a lot of technology. It is considered to be a strategic element by the United States. Beryllium copper alloys are highly useful because it's very conductive, again, very stiff, very, you know, strong material. It does tend to be, it's stiff in that it could be a little brittle as well, so it wouldn't be good in applications where being excessively brittle is a problem. But of course, you could make alloys out of it. So you could tweak the properties of alloys by what materials you mix it with. So beryllium alloys are used in high-speed aircraft, missiles, spacecraft, communication satellites. They're used in X-ray machines because beryllium is relatively transparent to X-rays, which is an interesting property. It's used in your cell phone. Your cell phone probably has some beryllium in it.
I probably have a little beryllium in me.
It's also, you do have a little bit of beryllium in you. It is the primary ingredient used to make the mirrors in the James Webb Space Telescope.
Sweet.
Oh, that's cool.
Most of the beryllium is mined in the United States, about 85%. Yeah, the rest is in China. Most of the rest is comes from China. Yeah. I knew very little about it. When I started reading about it, I'm like, holy crap, this is like an essential element of our modern civilization. I knew virtually nothing about.
You never hear about it.
Gotcha. Beryllium. And it's a cool name, isn't it? Beryllium?
It is. I do. I've always loved it. Beryllium.
It totally sounds like a science fiction.
It does.
Metal that they...
I was talking to Jay about it. I was like, in a way... Like, sometimes I like to think, like, if mithril silver actually existed, what would it be in real life? Because, there's no extra element out there that we don't know about.
All right, let's go through the list real quick, Steve. So, mithril.
There's no extra element.
Mithril has what properties? It's super light, super strong. It's bright, silver, shiny. It's seemingly magical.
So, a beryllium alloy could get you pretty close to the qualities of mithril silver. Like if you had a silver beryllium or even platinum beryllium alloy, it's good for armor because it's light and it's very strong. I don't think it would hold an edge. So, but of course, you make an alloy with steel, or you can use a beryllium core for the stiffness, and then you put a steel outer layer on for the edge and the hardness. I do think that just because it's so light and strong, right? It does have the key properties that are often touted for certain magical materials like mithril.
Very exciting.
It is. A beryllium titanium alloy would be amazing. That would be a good thing to make your robot body out of.
Sweet.
Okay. Let's go on to some news items. Jay, you're going to start off by getting us updated on these Hawaiian telescope protests. We've talked about this before, but what's going on?
Yeah, it's been an unfolding story. So on the main island of Hawaii, hundreds of protesters are blocking the construction of a new 30-meter telescope. That's pretty damn big. The location is on Mauna Kea, which, if you remember, was in Science or Fiction not too long ago, right, guys? It had something to do with the height. Remember, like this mountain
it's
has
the highest mountain from the base, but of course the base is underwater.
Right. But it does give you this gigantic scope of how big it is. So it's 13,796 feet, which is 4,205 meters above the sea. But it also goes down below the sea, 19,700 feet, which is 6,000 meters. That is huge.
Yeah.
So there are currently 13 telescopes on the mountain now, and this is because of a few different factors. And these are really fun factors here. First, it's near the equator, which what, Bob? It means that the atmosphere is a little bit thinner than in other places?
No, I don't think the equator feature is about it's the height of the mountain.
It's all about the height. You're above.
But being at the equator means it moves all the way. It rotates all the way around. If you were in the North Pole, you'd only get to see half the sky, right? If you're on the equator, you get to see the whole sky.
But Jay, it's all about being above most of the distortion effects of the atmosphere.
Yeah.
See, I definitely read that there are going to be a lot of rocket facilities are going to be on the equator because it's easier to get into orbit from the equator than it
is. That's right. But that's because of the rotation of the Earth.
Yeah, that imparts a velocity of like 1,000 miles an hour just by launching at the equator.
And the UFOs don't fly over the equator, so they don't block the right.
That's a big plus.
It's a no-fly zone for ET.
So the truth here is that it's low humidity and relatively clear skies near the summit. It's also far enough away from city lights to give it a great view of the night sky. And some of the world's largest telescopes happen to be there. I wonder why. It's because of all these properties. So we have the twin 10M Keck telescopes and the 8.2 millimeter Subaru telescope. These are two very big and unbelievably frequently used telescopes. And both of the teams that work at these telescopes have unfortunately been evacuated on July 16th because the protests started on the 15th. So why would hundreds of people protest and block the construction of this new 30-meter telescope? What's wrong with science, people? What's wrong with this? There was already a 4-year delay because of a lawsuit trying to claim the construction permit wasn't valid. But why did they do that? Hawaii's state Supreme Court ruled that the $1.4 billion project is valid and can continue construction on the 15th. But the protesters' main point wasn't about the permit. That was just them trying to block the construction. And the reason why they're doing it is because the mountain is sacred. It's sacred. Mm-hmm. It really has religious meaning to them. And that, you know, they're culturally, you know, these types of land masses and these types of constructs, you know, have some type of sacred properties.
Yeah. And when we talked about this last fall, we talked about that specifically. They feel like they've already given up enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
As far as what is already there, and any more is going to do a level of irreparable harm to their society, their culture, their institutions there, essentially, that they'll never be able to get back at this point. So they feel like this is the line in the sand they're going to draw.
Exactly. Evan, you totally hit the nail on the head. It took me a while to find that exact fact. I had to read a lot to get to that point. And, you know, a part of me is like, come on, this is like, this mountain is perfectly poised to have telescopes. But at the same time, you know, I do also agree with conservation and you know, like, let's not, you know, just because it is a great thing to have this 30-meter telescope doesn't mean that we should haphazardly just be, you know, building things everywhere. So I'm moderately torn. As much as I want to see the telescope go up, I'd like to make sure at the very least that they're not like hurting the, you know, whatever. There could be indigenous creatures there. There could be, you know, here's a question. Let's talk about this. What if the telescope facilities ruin the skyline? What if, you know, like when you look at the mountain, it just looks like it has a bunch of stuff on it now, and it's not as beautiful as it once was.
Yeah.
Well, it already does.
Yeah.
It already does. But that's subjective.
But that's not the issue.
I personally think telescopes are beautiful, but I agree. I think the two issues are, one is just, you know, is this going to be a blight on the natural beauty of the mountain? That's a bit subjective. And of course, you know, you can design this project and execute it in a way to be maximally respectful to the environment and minimally destructive and make sure you clean up after yourself and all that good stuff. And I think they've already gone through all of that, those kinds of objections. But I think the most valid thing here for me is that, you know, it's their island and we're invading it. We basically took it over and they like, hey, you know, we should be able to say what happens to our own land. And you guys are the foreigners here. And, you know, you're kind of just stepping all over our sacred mountain. I've been following this story and there's been a lot of back and forth and trying to work with the indigenous people to be maximally respectful and to make sure that they're involved in the decision-making process. And I had the sense that that was moving in a positive direction. So I was a little surprised. But I'm not there, like embedded in what's happening. And just from the reporting that I was reading, I thought, oh, okay, they're making some progress here. They went back, they engaged with the community, they're getting them involved. It seemed like they were trying to do the right thing. So I think this is a last sort of ditch protest, maybe by individuals who felt that they weren't part of the process or just who were never in agreement with it to begin with. But I think their complaints are totally valid. I just hope that we can work out, you know, an understanding so that they can feel invested in and part of, you know, this wonderful science that we could do by using the natural resource of that mountain without disrespecting their culture and their ownership and their history, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the tricky thing here is, Steve, it really is just like what Evan said. And they're like, enough's enough. We've already, you know, made so many allowances. Like, what you need, you know, when is it going to stop? I guess that's, you know, one of their questions. Yeah.
And I think, like, to say too that, you know, everything looked like it was trending in the right direction and stuff, which may be true, but we have to remember that all of the reporting that we're reading is Edic reporting. It's written by Westerners.
Yeah, I know. That's
what I'm
saying.
It's written by the people. So, like, it's maybe not that surprising that there would be a big protest because we don't know the state of the, you know, indigenous groups and where they sit and stand with all of this. And I think it's such a tough thing, right? Because even the way that we're talking about it right now is very like them, they. But it's, from their perspective, our country.
Oh, yeah,
and
absolutely.
Our mountain.
This is their home.
Their home.
Yeah, but I hope that we can come to an understanding, you know, and because I do think that, you know, it's possible for that mountain to be the site of the telescope while being respectful, you know, to their history and their heritage.
Maybe. We don't know because we don't know what the parameters are.
Yeah, we don't know. I hope it's that.
I can't dictate that. The worry, though, is just that, like, we have a very long history of coming to understandings through means that haven't always been, have almost never been kosher means. You know what I mean?
So, like, we're conquerors.
Yeah, coming to an understanding with the indigenous people oftentimes doesn't really mean coming to an understanding.
Doesn't always end well for them.
Well, 17th, 18th century examples are not good ones.
But even modern examples, there's usually some level of coercion or some level of, you know, cultural kind of muscle that comes into play that may be pretty nuanced and it may not be overt. And so we have to remember that as well, that like being in a position of privilege and power and authority and trying to push is not always the most appropriate way to go about these things.
And that is why this has taken, are we in the fourth year of this?
Something like that.
Coming to an understanding with the folks there.
This is a bigger issue that we've talked about in other contexts as well. You know, the deep issue is balancing the history of colonialism and imperialism and abuse in many cases of Native peoples, balancing that history with a genuine attempt to be fair and respectful, but also by getting them to understand some modern realities. Like, okay, I get that you've been hunting whales your whole existence, but, you know, it's just not a sustainable thing anymore. It may not be your fault that it's not sustainable, but that's the fact.
No, it's our fault that it's not sustainable.
Yeah, no, I get that, but we still have to deal with the reality that that's the way it is.
Yeah, but I think the way we deal with that reality should be more painful for us than it is for them.
I agree with that too. We should take the hit. I agree. For the problems that we caused historically, we should, you know, and we have the resources. We're the rich nations. We should take the
hit. We're the benefactors of it. So we should
absolutely. But that doesn't mean that we should just say give them carte blanche because we can't in any way challenge their traditions. I we can't go that extreme either, because they, some of their traditions may be harmful, you know, to their own people or to the environment or to whatever, you know. So
generally indigenous traditions are pretty sustainable.
I disagree, Kara. I think that is a naive view of history. That is just another Western bias. That is the you know, benign native Western, you know, romantic image that we have, that's not always true. Indigenous native peoples have historically been horrible to their local environment. That's just a historical fact.
And they've enslaved other people and done all the horrible things that we've done in our past.
Yeah, but I'm not talking about
including
that. I'm specifically talking about sustainability.
No, but they arguably wiped out the megafauna of North America. That was not sustainable, you know, for example. But I'm just saying, and again, that's
a very broad brush that you're painting.
I'm just saying that
I don't think it's fair to say that.
Of course it's a broad brush. I'm just, but you were painting with a broad brush. I'm just saying it's.
Yeah, I think it is fair to paint with a broad brush that the vast majority of indigenous cultures have had sustainable land practices. I think I can paint that broad brush. I think we can pick out certain situations in which land practices were less sustainable, but I think especially when compared to modern post-industrial land practices, indigenous land practices are more sustainable.
Well, I think that mainly comes down to population. You can't make a comparison.
Absolutely. Yes, you can. And you have to. And that's why I think when we say things like, well, we can't just let them have carte blanche, like, ugh, what? Yes. First of all, it's not our place to let anybody do anything. If somebody owns the land that they live on and lives in a part of the world, they have carte blanche. It's not our job to impose our ideas on them. If they're doing something that then affects our culture and society in a negative way, yeah, then a conversation can be had. But it is not our God-given right to put telescopes on mountains all over the world.
Oh, I agree, and that's not what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But I can't agree with that completely, because if we talk about the whale hunting thing, mm-hmm. that's definitely outside the borders of whatever land they historically own. That's, you know, they're hunting a species, which, again, it's not their fault that they're on the brink of extinction, but that's the reality now. And we have to deal with that. And also,
but I think it's also really unfair to kind of have that conversation. It's like when I remember when I used to live in New York and I had this amazing roommate and he was so funny. And I came home once and I went to eat some ice cream out of my out of the pint that was in the freezer. And I was like, Mike, you ate all the ice cream. And he was like, I ate a little bit of the ice cream. I just happened to eat the last little bit. The very bottom.
Yeah.
And it was like, touche, my friend. And that's kind of true, because we basically hunted whales to extinction. It is kind of effed up of us to say you can no longer hunt because they're critically endangered, I think. But I'm a cultural contextualist. I think there are certain cultural practices that are fundamentally amoral across the globe, and I fight against those cultural practices. But beyond those core cultural practices, I don't think it is my place to impose my moral view.
Yeah, that was where cultures. I was going with that exactly, Kara, is the idea that there are certain things like, you know, oppression of women or enslavement mm-hmm. or murder or whatever, where we could say, all right, we like it or not, we do live in a global, you know, world. There, to some extent, we're all one species. We all share this planet. I do think we could say, yeah, there are certain things that we can impose upon other cultures because they're just a basic fundamental things that we all have to agree on, even if we all haven't gotten there yet. And I do think, like, not hunting a species to extinction is one of those things. And that has to take priority over, like, who gets the blame. I think that with the who gets the blame thing is a good reason to say, like, okay, we will compensate you. We will bend over backwards to compensate you for the fact that we have basically effed you out of your basic historical means of sustainability because we hunted, you know, whales to the brink of extinction. So now you can't do it anymore. Or
the problem is that's just an idealistic view. We don't do that. We can't even pay reparations in our own country.
I'm saying we should do that. And I think we can do that. I think we are building international institutions that I do think can do some of that.
But I just don't think we will. And I think, so I feel I'm not like so we pessimistic. Have to be realistic.
But in this particular case, what are we talking about?
What I would like to see in this case is going back to what Jay was saying at the very beginning. And again, I haven't researched this issue, you know, nearly even to the extent that Jay has. So I'm not sure where I stand on it, but I am interested. You talked about all these, this constellation of reasons that this mountain is a perfect site. Are there no other equally interesting, viable, almost as good sites?
No, there are. And they have backup sites they would go to if this falls through.
Yeah, I think they were actually very close to using the backup site.
So why are we why is the fight so intense for this one?
Because the site's better, cheaper, and it's American. I think those
right, because it's American, right? The other sites,
I think it's literally the best choice
south of the equator.
It is
on the planet.
It's the best choice other than, you know,
the backups,
other than the cultural ramifications.
Right. Yeah. So that's right. Yeah, listen, I certainly hope we could work it out, but I would be okay with being deferential, you know, mm-hmm. to the indigenous populations. I think that's a good default position. The other analogy here that I wanted to mm-hmm. bring up really quick is releasing carbon into the atmosphere, right? So Western civilizations have basically used up the world's carbon budget, and now we're telling developing nations that, sorry, you can't release any more carbon into the world. You can't build your coal-fired plants that we use to lift ourselves, you know, into the industrial age.
We have no right.
You can't
beat them to it.
Yeah, we beat you to it. But that sucks. It's not fair in the cosmic sense, but it's also just the reality. And so I would say, but in the same line of reasoning, that doesn't mean we should let them do it or be okay with them. You know, I know the let them is problematic, but be okay with them. Say, okay, yeah, fine. We burned our way through coal and now you get to do the same thing. The fact that the earth is going to be, you know, the environment is going to be horrific as a result, I guess we'll just have to live with that. I don't think that's the conclusion that we come to. I think we say, all right, our bad. We didn't know it at the time, but we were using up a limited budget for the world. We used up your budget too. So now
also, we knew.
Well, we didn't really, really know.
We knew.
150 years ago?
No, but that's not when we used most of that coal, is
that's
it?
No, that's not. Well, I don't know if that's true. whatever. That's a different argument. But we were.
Yeah, I know, but that's the problem.
You know what London was like 200 years ago? It was
London and America were equivalent.
They were choked with coal.
But we're the West. We're no different from one another in that.
Oh, yeah. My point is that, we before and after we knew it was a problem, we continue to. We are still doing it. Mm-hmm. We are still burning our way through the world's carbon budget. And so I think, you know, through the UN, through the world gets together and says, all right, what are we going to do to try to mitigate global warming? I absolutely think that gets taken into account. You know, that
and it does. It currently is. I mean, there's nobody's arguing that. It's just, it's broken. It's a very broken system, as we know. And we are not doing what you said. We are not setting an example. We are not cutting our emissions.
That's because we don't have our own political.
And we are not paying, you know, helping lift these developing countries into a more green, sustainable future. Like, it's just, it's a bummer. I don't want to get really, really dark on it, but. I think that the arguments for how things should happen are great. The problem is they're not happening that way.
Oh, I agree.
What we can try to do is hedge and mitigate and try our best to always be really, really humble and really understanding and try not to maintain an us versus them mentality, which we have historically maintained for our entire existence.
Yeah.
And that's what gets us into this. Yeah. Into this problem.
But it's a thorny mess with no easy solutions is the other.
For sure. But I also think that we've been talking about things like carbon emissions and about things like whale populations that are being decimated. But this is a telescope. And although it's going to bring us amazing knowledge, it's not potentially going to save lives. It might. But ultimately, I do think that sometimes the risk-benefit analysis has to come into play. Like, the actual critical effect it's going to have on people has to come into play.
Yeah. Oh, I agree. I mean, I would be disappointed if they can't work it out so that everyone's happy. That's what I want. But it wouldn't be as devastating as, these species of whale goes extinct. That's
I
feel much more strongly about that, you know. Or
I think we all do. Yeah.
All right.
I have the solution, Steve.
Okay, tell me.
What?
Jay. Okay, yeah,
they should knock down the other telescopes and just put up this new awesome one and just not use any more land. I know it sounds crazy, but you know, like...
Well, that's not a bad idea. I mean, not all of them, but maybe there are there one of those telescopes they could retire and upgrade to the 30-meter telescope? That's an interesting idea. But
yeah.
I don't know the details. Maybe they're all being used and they're all still very valuable.
I mean, Keck is... I know
Keck,
Keck
absolutely.
Like, people use
Keck
it all the time.
Is, we hear
Keck
about it every month.
That would be bad.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on. Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, The Great Courses Plus.
Guys, with The Great Courses Plus's streaming service, you have the freedom to learn about really almost anything that you're interested in. You could become well-versed in almost any topic.
And this week, we're recommending a fascinating course called The Science of Information from Language to Black Holes. It's taught by Professor Benjamin Schumacher, who has been a professor of physics at Kenyon College for 20 years. And it really does run the gamut. I mean, information, what a massive topic. So all the way from computation to entropy to how we encode images and sounds, cryptanalysis, the brain, genetic information, even qubits and quantum information.
Yeah, getting into this course, it's really good. Information is one of those basic concepts. That's like really a building block of a lot of other concepts. And it's just good to go beyond a colloquial understanding of it to like to really understand it philosophically and scientifically.
So sign up now for The Great Courses Plus because they're offering Skeptics Guide listeners a free trial. So get started today. Go to our special URL, thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
That's thegreatcoursesplus.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Bob, tell us about LightSail 2.
All right, guys, the Planetary Society's LightSail 2 CubeSat has deployed its sails in Earth orbit as a prelude to sailing and testing the technology around the Earth for the next year or so.
Awesome.
So definitely a milestone in solar sails. So many of our listeners, I'm sure, and you guys have heard about the Planetary Society, right? Founded in 1980 by Bruce Murray, Lewis Friedman, and of course, say it, Evan.
Carl Sagan.
it's the world's largest nonprofit space organization, and Sagan was its first president, by the way. And now, of course, the president is some guy named Bill Nye, I think.
I've heard of him.
The history of solar sailing is interesting. Who first suggested it, guys? When? Give me a date or
solar
a name.
Sailing.
Oh, gosh. First suggested?
First suggested. Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yes, in Titanic.
DiCaprio.
It's like, I'm sinking. I wish I had a sail right now.
No, I would say Arthur C. Clarke.
Johannes Kepler. Early 1600s. That surprised me a bit.
I was closer.
But if you think about it, right, you were, I think. But if you think about it, it makes sense because all you really have to do is look at a comet, right? Look at the comet tail always pointing away from the sun. And he's hypothesized that maybe, you know, there's a, you know, cause and effect going on there. And in fact, he actually wrote a letter to Galileo in 1610. He wrote, "Provide ships or sails adapted to the heavenly breezes, and there will be some who will travel even that void."
My gosh.
Really cool. The next big milestone that I found was Arthur C. Clarke, Sunjammer book he wrote in 1964 that mentions solar sails. But the first...
That's what I was thinking of.
I'm sure. So now Carl Sagan was really among the very first to really push for non-fictional solar sails. He was actually on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson in 1976, and he pulled a model of a solar sail out from behind his seat. And he said, it can go out from the sun, it can tack inwards to the sun, and because it has a constant acceleration, it can get you around the inner part of the solar system a lot faster and a lot more conveniently than the usual sorts of rocket propulsion. Now, remember, this is 1976, and 34 years later before we really, really had the first really successful solar sail deployment, and this was in 2010, the Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency, JAXA. This was a demonstration flight. It was the Icarus. This is in May of that year. NASA, that same year, later in that year, in November, also launched a small CubeSat sail named NanoSail D. So those are the two big launches previously. The Planetary Society actually, they almost became the very first to launch a solar sail. This was in 2005, but they had some issues with the launch. And this was their Cosmos 1, and unfortunately that didn't get a chance to be deployed. Otherwise, they would have been the first. But since then, really, this active solar sailing has been in a moribund state. Really not a lot happening, nothing dramatic since 2010. And that ended yesterday, July 23rd. The Planetary Society well, they didn't actually launch it, but this is their CubeSat.
Is this the one that launched last month,
yes,
Bob?
It was
about
June
25th. A month ago this went up?
Yep, it launched June 25th. And a CubeSat is basically a tiny, tiny satellite about as big as a shoebox. And yesterday it was commanded to unfurl its thin Mylar sheet. The sheet was actually, if you saw the comparison, compare a shoebox and put that in the middle of a boxing ring. So that's the comparison, the ratio of the CubeSat compared to the unfurled solar sail. So pretty cool, pretty dramatic. And over the next year, it will prove, basically one of the main things it wants to do is prove that you could actually navigate and do stuff. And it's going to be changing orbits using just a solar sail, no fuel, nothing else but the photons from the sun and imparting their momentum to the sail. And what's going to happen is as it's doing the orbit, it's going to increase its orbit on one side of the Earth only. And then when it goes to the opposite side, it's going to be a little lower. So if you can imagine, the orbit is going to be kind of shifting, higher on one side, lower on the other. So that means...
So it will move faster, accelerate?
Well, if you're going to increase orbit, you're going to be accelerating. But that means, I guess by the nature of the design, it means that as you get farther away on one side, you're going to get closer on the other, which means that eventually the drag will eventually cause it to deorbit and crash or burn up. And I'm sure burn up in a year or so. But that won't matter because their goal is to show that this actually is viable and kind of set the stage for really starting to share their design, not only share their design, but eventually in the future, creating these commercial applications for small satellites. You could use them to increase your orbit, your altitude. You could do it for, and eventually you could do it. Who knows? Hopefully, we'll see spaceships that could use it and have some sort of role in exploring the solar solar
launch
system.
Probes,
right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, no fuel going at anywhere in the solar system. That's amazing. Of course, it could take some time depending on how it's applied. Let's see, Bill Nye quote time. He said, "Solar sailing is in its infancy, but it may become a game changer. We'll soon be able to send our solar sail spacecraft to all sorts of destinations in our solar system and perhaps to another star system one day." And of course, that brings me to one of the aspects of this that I'm very, very excited about. And that's the whole idea of laser-assisted solar sails.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, we've discussed that.
They go fast.
Yeah, we've discussed that.
Oh my gosh,
that.
They go fast.
Yeah, we've discussed that on our show once or twice. And to send anything, even something super, super tiny, to another star system, that this is our best chance to do that within a human lifespan. Doing it with chemical rockets, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of years, but using lasers to accelerate a very, very small, like we're talking about on the order of grams, but using the very powerful lasers, you could actually accelerate it using the solar sail to 20% the speed of light. 60,000 kilometers per second.
Fast.
Crazy speed.
So cool.
Of course, it would be a flyby, and there's nothing there to decelerate it, really. Not enough. But in 20 years, you could actually get to the closest star system, the Centauri system, in 20 years within a fraction, a tiny chunk of a human lifespan, which is just so amazing to imagine that we could potentially get some imagery, some really close, and we know that there are exoplanets in that system, and some of them have very promising signatures for the potential of life. So that's something that it's just one of those grand engineering things that I think we would be just so fantastic to really start taking even more seriously than we're doing now. And I will end with a quote from Sasha Sagan. She says, "This is still one of the most feasible pathways to have real interstellar space travel in the future." Sasha Sagan, writer as well as the daughter of some guy named Sagan.
Cool. All right, very quickly, the item I wanted to talk about this week has to do with free speech and medical practicing medicine without a license. There was a very good legal decision, which was important. We really dodged a bullet here. It's one of those things that, you know, didn't get a lot of attention, I think, within skeptical circles. But actually, it was this is a critical legal precedent that is absolutely essential. So, all right, here's the backstory. A woman by the name of Heather Del Castillo she books herself as a holistic health coach based in Florida, and she was essentially being disciplined by the state of Florida for practicing medicine without a license because she was charging for her health advice and she's not qualified. She's not licensed. She doesn't have the qualifications. And so that runs afoul of the healthcare licensing laws in the state of Florida. So the Institute for Justice, which is a libertarian public interest law firm, decided to defend her case. And they made their legal defense was that Del Castillo has a First Amendment right to free speech and that the state of Florida cannot impede that free speech by saying that it's not legal for her to give her health advice. So that was their legal theory. The judge completely dismissed that theory, like out of hand, said, nope, you are incorrect. So this is a very critical concept. The idea is that while, yes, yeah, the First Amendment grants citizens very broad and well-protected rights to free speech, there are certain limits. First, there's a lot of confusion on when the First Amendment even applies. I mean, if you are ever engaged online, you will, read people screaming about their free speech rights all the time or their First Amendment rights when on issues that are not First Amendment issues. The First Amendment only applies when the government is involved in some way.
Yeah, right? They cannot stifle your speech.
So if somebody wants to ban you from the comments of their blog, that is not a First Amendment issue. You essentially have – the First Amendment does not grant you a right to speech on someone else's private venue. All it says is Congress shall pass no law abridging the freedom of speech.
Right.
It's only a First Amendment issue when the law or the government is involved in some way. But even then, there are certain exceptions to First Amendment protection, some of which are obvious, some of which may not be so obvious. So, for example, child pornography is not protected speech. Obscenity is a tricky one. It's not – obscenity can technically be banned, can be censored, but the state really has the burden of proof there. And over the years, it seems that individuals have been given more and more leeway. That is kind of fading away as one of the exceptions. You cannot incite somebody to immediate specific violence.
Right.
You also cannot make credible threats against somebody that puts them at risk. So it has to be a credible threat, and it has to actually put somebody at risk. And of course, libel and slander. But those claiming libel and slander have a very high bar legally, and the assumption of innocence is on the person being accused.
Mm-hmm.
But here's the relevant exception here, and that is commercial speech. So there is still freedom of commercial speech, but it is much more limited than private or personal speech because commercial speech can be regulated when the state has a compelling interest to do so, as long as they are doing it in a minimalistic and very narrowly tailored way, right? So the state could say, there is a public interest in restricting this kind of commercial speech, so we are going to do it in this very specific way, which doesn't tread on speech more generally than it has to, right? So, for example, fraud. Your right to free speech doesn't give you the right to defraud other people, and the state has the right, to essentially criminalize or limit your ability to commit fraud because they have an interest, a free market in maintaining the law and protecting its citizens from being defrauded. That is the exception that's relevant in this case. The judge decided, and in his decision, he specifically says, the state has a compelling interest in order to protect the public interest against health fraud, right? So they have a right to maintain quality of standards of care and ethics through the licensure process. And that means they have to be able to restrict people from engaging in those professions without a license. Otherwise, the license means nothing.
Right.
So imagine what this country would be like if Heather Del Castillo won this case, if the judge decided that, oh, okay, your freedom of speech means the state cannot enforce professional licensure laws. That would mean zero
quality, everything.
There'll be chaos. Be good. No standard of care. Anybody could hang up a shingle and practice any profession they wish. You know, especially if the practice was strictly limited to giving advice or to providing services, then it would be completely Wild West. You could still say, they wouldn't be able to prescribe medication or maybe do, you know, surgical procedures or whatever. But, you know, I don't think I'm making a slippery slope argument to say that if, you know, free speech were used as an excuse to essentially eliminate licensure for professions, that would not be far behind. You know, I think that we would essentially lose any ability, the state would lose any ability to regulate that kind of behavior if that, once that legal precedent were set. So this is a critical legal precedent. I'm very happy to see that it was affirmed in a Florida federal court, because otherwise it would have been an absolute disaster.
Are they going to do? Is this woman going to appeal?
Yeah, they're appealing.
Yeah.
Yep. Her lawyer said the judge is wrong, and we're going to appeal. So
okay, now we need to wait for an appellate court.
And then maybe even the Supreme Court.
And then there would be the Supreme Court.
Two steps away from the Supreme Court. Yep.
Yep. Yep. Interesting. The war's not over, but it's a big victory for a battle.
This is a good victory. I don't think my hope is, I'm not an expert in this area, but from I do pay attention very closely to this, that the only time the Supreme Court would listen to it is if the appellate courts disagreed or there was clarification needed. But if all the lower courts are agreeing that, states have a compelling narrow interest in regulating professional commercial speech in order to maintain their right to police licenses, right? If that's the case, then the Supreme Court has no reason to hear the case because all the lower courts agree. But whatever, you can never really predict those things completely.
You never ever know.
That's right. That's right. Okay, let's move on. All right, Kara, so tell me, how much of autism is genetic? What does the science say?
The science says most of it, to be honest. So there's a new study that just came out where it was actually a really big, intense epidemiological study. So what they were looking at is a cohort of 5 different countries: Denmark, Finland, Sweden, Israel, and Western Australia. And they looked at over 2 million children from these countries over the span of like 15 years. Like, for a lot of them, it was like birth until they were age 16. The spans were a little bit different country to country, but that doesn't matter. On average, they were looking at birth to 16 years for 2 million children across these 5 countries. And what they wanted to do is pull out how many of them ended up being diagnosed with autism or something along the spectrum. So they lumped everything together, autism spectrum disorders. And they found that amongst these over 2 million, 22,156 had been diagnosed within that developmental period with autism spectrum disorders. And once they did all of their fancy schmancy statistical calculations, they found that the approximate amount of variance that was accounted for by purely genetic factors was 80%.
Yeah, that's 80%
heritability. That's a big chunk. Wow. And so we've got to remember that the other 20% could be a number of things. So they weren't specifically looking at that 20%. They were specifically looking at heritability, which means that everything that was not heritability falls into that other bucket. So this could be environmental factors. This could be, we were discussing earlier, like epigenetic things, like things that could potentially turn genes on or off.
It could also be, Kara, it could also be de novo mutations.
Yeah, so, just random, like new stuff popping up. You're right.
So yeah, if the child has a mutation that they didn't inherit from their parent, that would be in that 20%, right?
Yep. Not in the 80%. Basically,
Even though it's still technically genetic.
It's still genetic, you're right. But anything that's not heritability, and that's the important thing. Because I think a lot of terms get thrown around in the coverage of this.
Yeah.
And it is kind of complicated. Like, you have to kind of know a little something-something about genetics to understand it. They also looked at maternal factors. Apparently, this is an argument from the anti-vaxxer crowd, right? So we've known for a long time that the main argument that we generally hear in anti-vax propaganda is vaccines cause autism, right? That's like the number one thing we hear. And usually the goalpost gets moved around a lot. It was thimerosal. It's specifically the MMR vaccine. It's not actually one vaccine. It's the vaccine schedule. There are too many all at once. So there's, you know, a lot. It's kind of hard to chase all the arguments because each individually requires a lot of science to unpack. They're not all the same argument. But I think in the minds of most people who don't really have the, I guess, scientific or maybe medical knowledge to understand the nuance, it's easy to paint all of those arguments with a broad brush and say, just in general, you know, vaccines are bad and autism rates have, you know, gone through the roof in the last 20 years. And it seems to be linked to vaccines. Obviously, this has been debunked time and time again. You don't need us to tell you on this show about, you know, Wakefield's studies being debunked, him losing his medical license, him basically going deep into kind of the crackpot world and continuing to try and push this rhetoric. Like, even with that recent, what was the documentary that he made recently?
Vaxxed.
Yeah. I mean, it's like, come on, man, like, just stay in the shadows for a while. But so, you know, you don't need us to tell you about all of these large arguments that we talk about constantly on SGU. This new study, it's nothing really new because there have been multiple studies that have been published showing a similar percentage of variants that was accounted for by heritability. But this is by far like the largest epidemiological study done. And it really, in a lot of ways, is kind of a nail in that coffin. They did, I mentioned, look at maternal, how do they phrase it? Maternal factors, I think. So these would be things like mom getting a vaccine while she was pregnant, mom getting, you know, a viral infection while she was pregnant, nutritional intake while she was pregnant. So anything that could have happened to the child in utero, for example, would be a maternal factor. And I think that they were able to account that was functionally zero. It was like less than 1% of the variants could be accounted for by maternal factors. So that's pretty strong evidence there that both the vast majority of autism cases require some sort of complicated genetic and I should say specifically heritable code there. You know, and we know that autism is not a single gene. We know it's not even a handful of genes. This is a very complicated spectrum of, I guess, what do we even call it now? Syndromes?
Well, there's
disorders.
Autism spectrum disorder.
And that's what they looked at specifically in this study. They didn't look at autism alone. They looked at autism spectrum disorder.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, of course, that also opens up another conversation, which we've had on the show before, and I don't really think we need to open up right now, but it's something to think about, which is the way we diagnose these things is also kind of complicated. So spectrum disorder is more inclusive, right? And it's looking at a constellation of features that seem to point to this syndrome or this disorder, whatever we want to call it. But it's not quite as, you know, point to point as, for example, type 1 diabetes. Like, it's much easier to diagnose type 1 diabetes because there are, you know, we've talked about it before. It was a, what's the word, right? Like, pathognomonic things. Like, you know, you have high,
there are very specific diagnostic criteria. But
exactly.
Yeah, whereas this is
but
a
autism spectrum is getting better, though. Like, I think that we are kind of both in the mental health community and also in the medical community getting better at seeing those signs and being able to quantify something or qualify something as an autism spectrum disorder. But that said, regardless of how it's diagnosed, regardless that it's a disorder and not a disease per se, quote unquote, because we've talked about that a lot on the show, across the board, it's highly heritable.
Mm-hmm.
There's something going on in the genetics of that child that were passed down from that child's parents that is influencing their development of these autistic symptoms. And it is much more, it accounts for much more of the variance within these cases than anything environmental. And so basically, this just goes to show that the arguments as they stand right now from the anti-vaxxer groups don't hold water. The argument that, what's their big one you were saying before, Steve, that like within the last 20 years, the number has like gone through the roof. So it must be because of the way that we're vaccinating. Well, that wouldn't be possible.
Right.
It isn't possible because this is 80% accounted for by heritable factors.
Yeah, but they also, they turn that around too and say, well, it can't be genetic because genetics can't change that quickly, can't change in 20 to 30 years. But their false assumption is that the increase in diagnoses is due to an increase in the actual incidence.
And not just in how we diagnose
disorders. We know it's not. We know that you can, most of it can be explained by broadening the diagnosis, increased surveillance, diagnostic substitution. Basically, we're looking for it more.
Yep.
And the best studies, you know, in my opinion, show that if you apply the same diagnostic criteria exactly over different age cohorts, the incidence of autism is actually flat. And so the simplest conclusion is that autism rates are not increasing, that we are just diagnosing it differently.
Absolutely. And I mean, that is parsimonious.
Mm-hmm.
There's so many lines of evidence to support that. It's
the
family unit is different now. The way that we are, you know, that we care for our children is different now. The way that we're able to notice these kinds of symptoms is different now. It's, you know, it just makes much more sense. It's a much more parsimonious explanation. And that said, even beyond that, the fact that this study shows that 80% of, you know, the variance is accounted for specifically by heritable factors, right there, it shows. I think in a way, it actually kind of takes also some of the burden, the psychological burden off of parents who have been looking for answers. You know, there's nothing you could have done.
Right.
Like, there's nothing you could have changed. This is just the way that genetics work. Sometimes people, their genes combine in such a way that they end up with certain things going on in their lives. Mm-hmm. And like, you didn't parent them incorrectly. You know, you gave them the nutrition that they needed. You gave them the life-saving vaccines that they needed. And those are all good things. And they were going to probably end up with these symptoms anyway.
Right.
And I think
they probably had them as, you know, they were recognizing them younger and younger, the more we more carefully we look for them. So
We're able to screen for autism like it in, like, I don't want to say infants yet, but like in young toddlers, right?
Well, studies show clear evidence of autism features as early as 6 months.
That's amazing. So far.
We may be able to push it back earlier than that, but definitely by 6 months. And that's, I think, just because it takes that long for the brain to develop to the point where you would see it, you know?
And also, there's these kinds of behaviors, too, are you have to contrast them to, like, neurotypical behaviors. And, like, babies just don't have a lot of behaviors.
Right.
Like,
right.
There are certain things that are obvious with babies, you know, certain disease states. But, like, for the most part, there's not a lot the babies give. They don't give you a lot to work
on. But I bet you there's more and more subtle manifestations that we will be able to pick up on, like the way they move their eyes or whatever. Just something we'll be able to say.
And those tend to be the
earlier
ones.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
that people are pointing to is like gaze and soothing, like capability to be soothed and things like that.
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah, it's a fascinating area of research. Obviously, a lot of people are working really hard on it because they see the pain that parents go through and the difficulty that parents go through when they first find out about the diagnosis and when they start making these behavioral changes to try and work with their children. But it's obviously a disorder that in many ways people are able to live full and healthy and wonderful lives with. And it's really cool that we're learning so much more about it. And it really bums me out that there's still a small but loud percentage of the population that is barking up the wrong tree, which is actually diverting attention from good research that could be done.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks, Kara.
Yep.
Well, everyone, we're going to take a quick break from our show to talk about one of our sponsors this week, KiwiCo.
KiwiCo creates these super cool hands-on projects for kids, and it makes learning about science a ton of fun. So with a KiwiCo subscription each month, the kid in your life, I have two, Steve has basically one at this point because one of his kids is no longer a kid, they will receive a fun, like really hands-on, fun, engaging project, and it'll help them develop their creativity and confidence.
The kit that my daughter and I received is the hand crank flashlight, which we had a ton of fun putting together. Just following the instructions, they make it reading so easy to follow. And at the same time, we're learning about wiring, we're learning about light, we're learning about engineering to a certain degree, and it is just an incredible experience.
And right now, KiwiCo is offering the Skeptic's Guide to the Universe listeners the chance to try them for free. So to redeem that offer and learn more about their projects for kids of all ages, just go to kiwico.com/skeptics. That's kiwico.com/skeptics.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. Evan, so I read this conspiracy theory that birds, that there are no birds in North America.
There's no birds.
What?
it's not a conspiracy theory.
Explain.
Explain this, please.
Three words, folks. Birds aren't real. And the internet told me so. It's all right there.
It's right in front of you.
I mean, birdsaren'treal.com. I mean, this is so official. It is look, from what the front page says, there's this button in which you go to birdsaren'treal.com. They have this button right on their front page. It says, read their flyer. Get it, flyer? Yeah. I thought that was funny. But Nick, the flyer, it's very simple. The flyer says, wake up. Okay, I'm woke. What we think are birds are actually government surveillance drones. That's it. That's basically the whole flyer.
Wait. Every bird is a drone?
Mm-hmm. Every bird is a drone.
Since when? Haven't there been birds since before drones?
Since Nixon.
That's right. It's all about Nixon. I'm going to get to the Nixon quote in a second. But for a little historical context, I mean, we have some situations here. Remember that mechanical owl that Hephaestus created and Athena sent to Perseus to help rescue Andromeda? The gods used that as a drone, basically a means for spying. Or how about the Hunger Games, right? Didn't they have mechanical birds to spy on the tributes in the Hunger Games? So there's all sorts of precedent for this. And then there is the quote from Richard Nixon. Here it is. We needed a way to keep an eye on the American citizens without them knowing. It was imperative for their own safety, of course. We hired only the best. It took years. We designed, built, tested, failed. But we persisted. Eventually, over decades, we had it. A fleet of covert technological surveillance devices unlike anything the world has ever seen. We called them birds. Yes, that's a real fake quote. That's on this website. And you have to take action now, Steve. They tell you, take action. Recent surveys have revealed 99.5% of the general public still believe in birds.
Maybe
that said, it is our duty, it's their duty, as bird truthers, to remove the blinders from their eyes and welcome them into the light of truth. Together, we can shift society's perception of what flies above us. Okay, so, does it take a trained skeptical eye spot this parody? Actually, a squirrel should be able to recognize that this is 100% satire, let alone a person.
Is this on The Onion?
No, you wish it were. It's an actual website.
It could be, but no.
Yeah.
It's the kind of thing. Do you remember Saturday Night Live? They used to make commercials, right?
For fake products, right?
Happy Fun Ball was one of them. I mean, this would be like, if you believed in this, you would believe that the Happy Fun Ball was a real product.
Do you know what my favorite one was? My favorite recent one, Evan?
Which one?
John Hamm's John Hamm. It was just like a roll of ham rolled up like toilet paper that was next to the toilet paper dispenser. So gross.
That is awesome.
John Hamm.
For when you're hungry. And John Hamm did the whole pitch for it. Like sitting on the toilet eating ham off a roll. Sorry. It was great.
So what we have here is satire, obviously. But are they trying to make a point to call out just how crazy some conspiracy theories actually are? It's a little unclear as to what the motivation is here and what the lesson is. What's our takeaway from this? What are we supposed to be learning from a website such as this?
Well, how many people picked it up and ran with it?
It's making the rounds.
That's probably the lesson. Like, come on, people. Look how obviously fake this is, and you still are buying into it.
Yeah, but here's the thing. So, I mean, I do think, although there's no tell, meaning that they don't say specifically this is satire anyway.
Not yet.
But, right. Yeah,
is a reveal
some,
coming.
Some people
right?
speculate that this is just all an attempt at branding to sell T-shirts and swag, right? And it probably will work.
They have an online store at the website. Yeah. Yep, and they are actually selling these things.
Or the other speculation is that this is sort of a sting operation against those silly conspiracy theorists, right? But I don't like this kind of thing because it does just pollute the environment. Mm-hmm. And when you think about it, is this really more ridiculous than the flat earthers? Not really.
More ridiculous.
It's about on the same level. And some people think that people parroting using the flat earth as a parody actually gave it a lot of its early steam. Right? Not that I'm predicting this is going to turn into a conspiracy theory that people actually believe in.
Right, a movement of some sort of legitimate.
But it really isn't that different from the flat earth movement, you know?
It has the same components, that's right.
Yeah, it's just as absurd. It's within the same order of magnitude. So I don't agree with pulling off hoaxes or this kind of parody, but presenting it as real. I don't believe that is an effective form of skeptical activism. I think it will basically backfire when you try to do things like that. And I don't think it would accomplish anything, because the stated goal is often, well, this will expose them for how gullible and stupid they are. It's like, okay, well, you don't really need to do that. I mean, they're sort of doing that on their own. And no one who would see that is going to be compelled by this example in any case. All you're really doing is making yourself untrustworthy and potentially accidentally creating another belief system.
Yeah.
We've seen it happen.
We've seen it happen. Well, gosh, I mean, 20 years ago, if we had predicted 20 years ago that the flat earth craze would get to the level that it has gotten to today, no way you would have taken that bet. It was absolutely no way you could have seen that coming. Yet
now
here it is.
I do like satire, legitimate satire.
Yeah, but me too.
Because I think it could be a great way to expose the fundamental contradiction or logic or whatever of position. Mm-hmm. But when I've done it in the past, I've always labeled it as satire.
Right.
And I learned that lesson the first time I published on my blog a really satirical article. I actually got contacted by journalists who legit thought it was real.
Was that the alternative engineering article?
Yeah.
Oh, so that's still one of my favorite articles. It's so good.
But I mean, I'm like, this is not real. This is satire. You know, but they were like serious journalists. From that point forward, I like clearly label it as satire, so there's no mistake.
You know what the other recent example of this is? Maybe not to this extent, but it's a little similar. The Let's Storm Area 51.
Oh yeah,
phenomenon.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, in which hundreds of thousands of people are interested in doing this crazy thing in September, in which they're going to try to rush Area 51 to demand that, you know, they release all their stuff. It's a ridiculous, crazy idea. But you're going to find, you get enough people out there kind of glomming onto something, some people are going to take it seriously.
No, it's not real. This guy said straight up, this is not real. I'm doing this. I just did this to get clicks on Facebook. He said that.
Right. After it was too, after, you know, after he got his 600,000th click.
Yeah, but I don't know anyone's taking it seriously. Maybe somebody in there is. But part of, he was also saying, we're going to storm Area 51 running Naruto style. You know, that anime style with your arms behind your back and facing forward. That was clearly just a goof. But it does take on a life of its own. And again, these things get out of the originator's control. And this prompted, because Area 51 is an actual secure military base, and they said, just to make no mistake here, it's not a good idea to storm a military base which is defended by armed soldiers.
You see, they tend to take these things seriously, defending.
We don't care if you're running like, you know, some comic book dude. Like, it doesn't matter. We're going to shoot you.
Right. Don't do it.
And, you know, since then, it has also spawned the plan to storm the Loch Ness to find the Loch Ness monster. That's got like 40,000 signatures.
Oh, I saw that.
And
people are going to drown if they do.
And Let's Storm the Bermuda Triangle is also out there now. Also with, you know, because now it's become kind of a joke.
They should storm the Apollo 11 landing site.
Yeah, the movie set, right, where they think that it was filmed. Oh gosh! So
yeah, but you laugh at that, but then that guy shot up that pizza joint that he thought there was a pedophile ring operating out of. So these things are not benign.
They're not. That is the point.
You cannot guarantee that they will be benign because you know.
Well, yeah, some people are not well, and they have. I like to call them a bit reality detached. I think that's putting it kindly.
Reality challenged. So we'll see. We'll see if anybody actually tries to storm Area 51. Hopefully not. Okay.
Be careful out there, guys.
Jay.
Yes.
It's Who's That Noisy Time? But before you get us up to date on Who's That Noisy, you have a little bit of a correction to make from the previous one.
But I'm going to tell you right out of the gate, to those of you listening to Who's That Noisy, I'm sorry. I am sorry, legitimately. This is what happened. I'm kidding. I'm partially kidding. So what happened was I reported on a news item about, which was this, Steve? Because I'm
a couple weeks ago.
It was at least 2 weeks ago. This was the one about the female Russian cosmonaut. And in that, Who's That Noisy? I said, and I don't remember my exact wording. I said something along the lines of, and this is a recording of her. Upon re-entry, and she died, and I thought that I threw out there a little disclaimer, like it was a conspiracy theory. We don't really know. The fact is, we do really know she did not die. She is absolutely alive. She is still alive.
Well, so just to clarify this, so Valentina Tereshkova was the first female cosmonaut in space. She's absolutely alive. The question was that a recording of another female cosmonaut that predated her? And right. I think, you got that – the fake first woman cosmonaut confused with the real first woman cosmonaut. But there's never any question that Valentina is, survived, landed, and is still alive.
I didn't research it. I took it on
– You took it at face value.
Then I did look up a couple of things. But what happened was I looked it up and I went to a freaking conspiracy website. I was like talking about this very – rationally. And it just seemed like, we're not 100% sure, and another factor for me legitimately was, I was a kid in the 80s, and in the 80s, Russia was still kind of like, big bad, like it was like a, fear of the Russian government type of thing. And I know that they're very secretive. And I thought, I wouldn't put it past them to hide, one of their cosmonauts getting killed.
Well, they did hide that. So that's the thing. So there were a lot of conspiracy theories in the West about the Soviet space program hiding accidents and deaths. And it turns out that they did do that, but they were only hiding ones that occurred on the launch pad. Like there was one where the rocket blew up on the launch pad and I think 120 people were killed.
Oh my gosh.
They covered that up, but not in space because
They
couldn't hide it. The U.S. was tracking whatever was happening in space.
And this all goes back to like the late 50s and 60s when the space race was heating up.
Yeah.
And both the countries were dumping tons of money into innovation and everything. And, this is really born on the societal fear of the Russian government and their secrecy, and the secrecy doubled and tripled down on people speculating, and that speculation turned into the missing cosmonauts.
Yeah.
And it's pretty cool.
The missing cosmonauts, in retrospect, that was all fake.
It was all fake, but legitimately there was people talking about it and feeling – there was a lot of buzz about this. Like it was one of the things that people talked about.
But wait, then who is the recording actually of?
Oh, that's a good question. Because Steve has this totally nailed, but there was these couple of dudes out where in Italy, Steve?
Yeah, two Italian amateur radio operators claimed to have just happened to capture this radio signals of the cosmonaut, burning up on reentry. But the thing that really – there's a couple of things that make it suspicious. But the big one is the same two – I think they were brothers, radio operators, captured multiple Russian cosmonauts dying in space and not just one. So that's why would they capture multiple instances? And certainly if they did it, wouldn't the American government have also – caught those recordings because we were listening into that sort of thing.
So.
It's a little more complicated, and it's fun. This is a really cool story. So one is their names were – now this is what Wikipedia says. The Giudica Cordiaglia brothers Cordiglia, right?
Cordiglia.
Yes, the Cordelia brothers. So one thing was ham radio at that time was very popular. They were saying that if you measured the tower, you could tell what frequency the person was transmitting at. That was one of the things I read about this.
Yeah, but Jay, did you know that at that time the radios were actually made out of ham?
I would love to believe that because think about it. You're in a survival situation. You're at a ham radio.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you get John hungry, ham radio.
And you're like, okay. I mean, that's why we make them out of ham and they eat it. So there was Steve, check this out. There was a bunch of things that they heard. They heard in May 1960, a manned spacecraft reports it's going off course.
Yeah.
November 28th, 1960, a faint SOS Morse code signal that they heard from a spacecraft leaving Earth's orbit. You know, there was one in February 61, April 61, May 61, October 61, November 1962, November 63, and April 64. So the November 1963,
wow, a female Soviets cosmonaut. Soviets were busy killing off their cosmonauts.
That one in November 1963, that was the female cosmonaut dies during reentry. Now, I got emailed from a listener who is a ham radio connoisseur and gourmand because he eats the ham radio when he's killing it. He said that the Russian accent was not legit.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
That words were not said correctly and whatnot.
And they weren't using the right protocol in how they were saying things, you know. It'd be like listening into NASA communication. You don't get that tone, that beep, you know, in between the talking.
Yeah. And the correct protocol when your spaceship is burning up is to scream into the microphone as loud as you can and not talk about how much you love your country. Like basically scream. And they didn't do that. And that's where how we know it's a fake.
All right, Jay. So get us up to date on Who's That Noisy.
So last week I played this noisy. Lots of clicks and springs and things moving around. Guys, you want to take a stab at this?
It's almost like tumblers on a lock, you know, trying to open a lock, but amplified.
Like a pick lock.
Well, so a listener named Glenn Brady said, okay, I'm going to guess that this week's noisy is dialing on a Decadic rotary dial telephone. That's a 10-unit based rotary dial phone. I'm really old, and this guy, like, I got to tell you, when I re-listen to that noisy, it certainly does in the beginning sound like somebody's dialing on an old-style rotary phone. That is not the correct answer, but it was a good guess. Next email was from John Henry, and he says, hey, Jay, longtime listener and fan, but my first guess at a noisy. It's an Enigma machine. If it's not and you want to record your own noisy of an Enigma operating, you can go to the National Cryptology Museum. That would be cool. Maybe I'll pull that out someday. Not correct. Now, the winner. Now, who do you guys think won? I'll give you a guess. He was at Nexus.
Oh, no way.
Oh, Silac?
Nope. But good guess.
Joe Bag of Donuts?
Charlie Ross. Charlie Ross.
Charlie
is our beloved friend
at Google.
And he's a patron. And he sent me this guess while we were both at Nexus, which was really funny. So he says, is this one of those super old adding machines with a crank handle? The kind from super old war era cartoons. And the answer is yes, it is. Absolutely is. Good guess, Charlie.
Oh, gosh.
I actually used one of those machines. Do you know why? You know who had one?
My dad.
Your grandfather?
No, our father had one in his office
when we
were kids, and I would friggin' use it.
It was fun.
Yeah, you press the buttons and they stay down. And then you crank the handle and then it
tallies up the numbers.
It tallies up the numbers and it prints it out on a piece of paper that comes out like a receipt. You know, like
there was like
paper.
There was a hundreds digit, a tens digit, a single digit.
Purely mechanical, purely.
But it had such a satisfying like when you pull the crank, it was like shik ching and then everything gets reset.
Like a slot machine.
Steve, what the hell happened to that damn thing? I would have totally kept that mother.
I know.
Because Bob, things go from brand new to old to shit. You throw them away, and then 10 or 20 years later, you're like, hey, whatever happened to that thing?
Too nostalgic.
That retro thing.
More than that, like 25 years.
I would love to have my little PC or like my Apple IIe or whatever it was from 1975 or whatever that was. You know what I mean? Those yeah. my yep, first I like my first crappy little computer, first, which was worthless, first. But now would be awesome if I had it.
Steve, you could get one on eBay. They sell them all the time, and they're not really that expensive.
Yeah.
I remember you, Bob, and I were at the Apple store, and what year could this have been? Early 80s? I don't even remember. It was like the Apple IIe just came out.
Yeah, early 80s. I think that was early 80s.
And the guy was putting the there was a panel you can open up on this computer. You can lift off like a big section of the part where the monitor rests on to get into the innards of the computer where the motherboard is and all the components. And the guy was closing the lid, and he hit it really hard. And he like, you know, and he it clicks back into place. Like these things were made very solid. And he goes, "You can't break your Apple." And Steve turned to me and Bob and said, "Did you hear what he just said?" Like we were blown away at that probably was a sales pitch, like how tough the computer is.
I also remember that they were selling a 10 megabyte hard drive.
Oh my, for $1,500 probably.
Yeah,
it's cavernous.
10 megabyte hard drive.
So to give you the
exactness,
that's like 1.5 songs.
What would you do with that? Yeah.
Oh my gosh!
You put one photo on there.
It's not even one photo.
So the person who sent this in was his name is Matthew DeMacus, and he said this is a Todd adding machine from the 20s. My grandmother gave it to me. She was an antiques dealer. The noise you hear is me adding the numbers 1934 and 1996 and clearing it. And that's that wonderful clearing noise you have to hear.
1934 plus one. What was the second number?
It was Carl Sagan. He said it's Carl Sagan's birth year and death year.
Oh, 996. Okay. Yep.
And another cool thing he said, you know, he says, why? Like, why did I pick those dates? Well, my grandmother's daughter, my mother, graduated with Carl Sagan, and he even signed her yearbook. How about that?
Okay, here's the answer. Yeah. 3,920. There you go.
Thank you, Evan.
You're welcome.
Carl called his mother vivacious and hard to understand. And then I think this was a guy, Bob, that said that we were the Bob and Jay conglomeration, right?
Oh, he can't tell the difference between your voices?
No. Because he always writes, "Dear Bob or Jay." That's what he says at the top of this email. Dear Jay or Bob.
Dear Jay, Bob.
So that was the second time that Carl Sagan has come up in this episode. So I'm going to tell you a third reference to Sagan. Are you ready?
Because things happen in three, right?
Yes. Go. So you know that my dog died a couple weeks ago.
Oh,
and my wife couldn't wait to get another dog. So we rescued this dog from Tennessee.
Yeah.
He's like a husky Australian sheepdog mix. And guess what his name is?
And guess what his name was.
No, this is the name that he has like on the listing for the rescue. This is not the name we're giving him.
Right.
He already had this name.
This is the name that he was given by whoever, you know. His name is Sagan.
Yeah, Sagan.
Love
Ooh,
it.
Yeah, coincidence.
Tomorrow we're going to go pick him up, and I'm going to have a new puppy dog named Sagan.
And because of all of this, because Steve's wife Jocelyn was feverishly looking up dogs on like Pet Finder and doing all the research and all that. So then, you know, my wife and I lost our dogs like 3 years ago. So we've been talking about getting one. So Steve is like, you know, Steve and Joss were sending us pictures of dogs. And next thing you know, we're going out looking at dogs. And then next thing you know, we find a dog and we adopted a dog on Monday.
Yep.
And his name is Lando. And he's awesome. He's awesome.
Of course, his name is Lando.
Yep. He's so adorable. Puppies are so much fun. They're just so, everybody knows it. And everybody wants to talk about their puppy and nobody wants to hear about it. So anyway, I have a new noisy.
It's not your puppy, is it?
No, sir. Thank you, sir. Okay, so this week's noisy was sent in by a listener named Ben Nolting. And here's the sound. If you think you know what this noisy is, if you want to sign up for DragonCon 2019 and come to our private show.
Yes.
Just kidding. Do not email me about this. Only email me about who's that noisy. You can email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org.
All right. Thank you, Jay. Well, everyone, we're going to take a break from our show to talk about another sponsor this week, GoTo Conferences.
GoTo Conferences is a software development conference series that attracts the top creators and leaders in tech. And thanks to their YouTube channel, which you can find at youtube.com/GoToConferences, that's GOTO Conferences, you can take advantage of more than 1,000 videos featuring the best talks from their events. 1,000 videos. They have entire playlists covering topics like microservices, DevOps, serverless, AI machine learning and deep learning,
woo-hoo,
the human factor in tech, connected worlds and Internet of Things, software architecture and security and privacy.
For example, you could check out Containers from Scratch with Liz Rice. This is a talk that breaks down what containers are and shows you exactly what's happening when you run a container.
You can subscribe for free at youtube.com/GoToConferences for all the latest talks covering the full stack of software development. You can also join GoToConferences in person. Their next events are in Berlin this October and Copenhagen in November. Register using the code SKEPTICS for 10% off your pass to any of their upcoming conferences.
Yeah, so check out their YouTube channel at youtube.com/GoToConferences. All right, guys, let's get back to the show.
It's time for Science or Fiction.
Each week I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake. Then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. Are you guys ready for this week?
Yes.
Yes.
Okay.
There is no theme this week. No theme. Just three news items. Here we go. Item number one. New research finds that artificial canned laughter decreased the degree to which subjects found comedy funny. Hmm. Item number two, a new study finds that the working memory of chimpanzees is substantially similar to that of humans. And item number three, researchers studying Asian elephants find that females living with sisters had significantly increased probability of annual reproduction. Jay, go first.
And here I am going first. All right, the first one here, new research finds that artificial canned laughter decreased the degree to which subjects found comedy funny. Well, I happen to know some fun things about artificial canned laughter, like the machine that this particular person invented to do it for TV shows.
The laugh track.
Cool. The laugh track, yeah. It was pretty complicated and pretty cool. There's quite a history on it. So, you know, they're saying that canned laughter decreased the degree in which subjects found comedy funny. I mean, I can believe this. I think it does help, I think, if people are laughing when you are seeing something funny, because when you're in a group or you're feeling, you know, that you're feeling that pulse of laughter, it could enhance your own laughter. But canned laughter sounds canned. And wait, is that the toupee fallacy?
Hmm?
Well, I'll just say, like, the in the study, you know, it's artificial canned laughter. In other words, the laughter sounds artificial. That's kind of the point of the study.
Gotcha. All right, thank you. That's very important. I'm glad I was thinking out loud there. Okay, so I would tend to think that that's true. Because the canned laughter is, when you hear it, it takes me out of the moment. I'm listening to the laughter and I'm not laughing with the laughter. Okay, a new study finds that the working memory of chimpanzees is substantially similar to that of humans. Wow, okay. I would think that we would have known this earlier if this were that true. Substantially similar to that of humans. The working memory. So we're talking about their moment-to-moment memory, like, you know, the short-term memory that's allowing you to stay in context with reality. I would imagine that it has to be there. They have to have that. But then I would think that our hard drive might be a little bit more nuanced than theirs. But that's okay. I got to read this last one. I'm not sure about that. Last one here, researchers studying Asian elephants find that females living with sisters had significantly increased probability of annual reproduction. Why would Asian elephants, if they're living with their female, if they're living with their sisters, have it significantly increased their probability of annual reproduction? Now, it could be that more of them attracted more males. I would hate to think that this has anything to do with their cycles and all that. Because I've read things saying that is incorrect, that women's cycles don't sync up and all that nonsense from hormones and pheromones, whatever. Okay, so one of these has to be fake, Steve. Damn you, Steve. These are fascinating and really, really good. It's definitely between the chimpanzees and the elephants. The elephants. And I would say that the elephant one is the fake.
Okay, Kara.
I think I'm going to have to say the opposite. I think that looking over all three of these, it's really hard to know which one it is. But I wouldn't be surprised if, even if the laughter sounds fake, people still have heightened responses to jokes, like to TV. Because I do think that there's this really strong psychological construct. Like when you watch TV alone, it's really rare that you laugh out loud. But if there's other people around and they're laughing at something, it really does increase your kind of humor response. So my guess is that whether it sounds real or fake, we're just so desensitized to the fact that laugh track sounds fake that they still tap into that kind of very interrelational need to hear and feel other people laughing. So I'm going to say that that one's the fiction, that it actually increased the degree to which subjects found comedy funny.
Okay, Evan?
Oh, boy. Well, I think I'm going to disagree with both Jay and Kara.
That's amazing. I don't like it when Evan goes out on his own.
I see it. I just see it differently. Laughter, you know, it's almost like yawning, you know, the contagious aspect of yawning. I think maybe laughter has a similar sort of contagion element to it. And if that were somehow artificially generated, it would not have the same impact as something as organic as the human laughter. So I think that's why that one's going to be the science. The chimpanzees, I think what's happening here is that, well, chimpanzees, I guess we are very closely related in our DNA to chimpanzees. What is it, 98-point-something% of our DNA?
It's hard to put an objective number on it, but it's somewhere between 96 and 98%.
Whenever you say chimpanzees, it's held up as the standard by which, you know, we compare to humans, like the closest of our relatives in the animal kingdom. But I don't think that this has a correlation as far as the working memory being substantially similar to that of humans. The human experience is just, you know, gosh, so many degrees removed from what the chimpanzees experience that I don't see how their processing in the memory department can really be the same or close to the same there. So, and then the last one about the females living with the sisters for the elephants, I just think with that one that elephants are what, communal animals and creatures. They do, you know, live in herds and have families, and it's established that this would, you know, that there's an impact there because of that very nature of the elephant herd, the elephant pack, I'm not sure what you exactly call it, that this would be a consequence of that. So I think that's why that's the science.
I believe it's a herd of elephants, right?
A herd of elephants. Is it a herd? Okay.
I think so.
I'll look it up to be sure, but I think so.
It's either a herd or a parade of elephants.
Oh, a parade. Interesting. Mm-hmm.
All right, Bob, you get to break the tie.
Let's start with three. The Asian elephant. That just sounds right to me. Something. I think that there's an analog. Is there an analog with humans? I'm not sure. That's not really making me. My spider sense is not tingling with that one. The chimpanzee in memory. I mean, that one kind of wouldn't be surprised one way or the other on that one. I mean, what we can hold in working memory. What, seven chunks at the same time, and if you put a new one in, the other one slides out, that type of thing. I think that's related to working memory. Sure, I could see chimpanzees having something very similar to that. The one that I disagree with, and I agree wholeheartedly with Kara about, is the canned laughter. Yeah, we hate it, you know, but people would hire professional laughers. That's what I heard. Never really confirmed that, but it made sense that you would hire somebody or multiple people to laugh in an audience to get people going. Because, you know, you got this, you know, people will hear laughter, and it just makes sense, and that you would join in if you hear other people laughing. So that one, yeah, that one just seems like, that seems like fiction to me. I think even though we hate it, and even if we can detect it and it's annoying, but when you hear somebody or a lot of people laughing, I think you would tend to think a little bit more than otherwise that it was funny. Fiction.
Okay. All right. So since you two guys chose number one, we'll take these in reverse order. We'll start with the third one. Researchers studying Asian elephants find that females living with sisters had significantly increased probability of annual reproduction. Jay, you think this one is the fiction?
Yep.
And this one is science. Of course. Yeah, because elephants are.
That was funny, Jay.
Elephants. It is, Jay, recently you've been on this tear where like you're like, oh, this one is absolutely true, 100%. You're talking about the fiction, of course. Like the more certain you are, there seems to be an inverse relationship there. But
so I have to Costanza these?
Yeah, you might
have to Costanza these. So the study shows that for long-lived social mammals, they were studying the idea that there's a benefit to the social structure. They were specifically looking at Asian elephants, and they wanted to know if you had a female Asian elephant, what's their probability of successfully having a baby over the course of a year, reproducing, and that probability was significantly increased if they were living with a female relative, especially a closely related relative like a sister, and especially if that sister was 0 to 5 years younger than they were. And this effect was stronger for younger female elephants. So the question is, why would this be the case?
Yeah.
And the idea, again, this study doesn't tell us why this is the case, just that it is the case. But the researchers speculate that younger female elephants just don't have the skills, the chops, you know, to make this happen. And that if they have the social support structure from other closely related females, that gives them an advantage. So it's like they're just not mature enough to know what to do, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it just, in general, in the animal kingdom, they find that there are, for social mammals, especially long-lived social mammals, there tends to be very complex, close female social hierarchies. And the thinking is that this is a result of the fact that the females of the species tend to stay together, whereas the males tend to leave and go out to find a mate.
Yeah.
The females stay together long throughout their whole life. Their whole lives, they may remain as a social unit, and that they need to support each other because it's the nature of the role that they fill domestically, and that there's advantages to evolving these support structures.
Yeah, especially in elephants. I don't know about Asian elephants, but in African elephants, it's like, oh, it's a matriarchal society. The bulls are off on their own. Yeah,
exactly.
That's cool.
Okay, let's go back to number two. A new study finds that the working memory of chimpanzees is substantially similar to that of humans. Evan, you are out on your own again.
Oh,
and thinking that this one is the fiction.
Well,
everyone else very nervously thinks that this one is science.
Steve, that's cruel to
and
do to
this one. This one is science, not this time, Evan. Sorry.
That's
all right. This was a bit surprising because, you know, people are smarter than chimpanzees, right? There's no question about that. And so working memory specifically is the ability to hold several bits of information in your head for a short period of time. For example, like one example they give in the study is so that you remember the beginning of the sentence when you get to the end of the sentence, right? That's sort of your short-term working memory. Mm-hmm. So that you could do math. You need to be able to hold those numbers in your head. So this was the paradigm that they came up with to test the chimpanzees. And they also did the same thing in children. They used chimpanzees versus human children in this study. They would show the chimpanzee that they were putting food into different little boxes that were different shapes and colors and also lined up in a row so they would be in a different arrangement. And then so the food was in some of the boxes and not in others. And then the chimpanzees would have to search for the food. And of course, once they found food in one box, there would no longer be food in that box. So if the boxes were covered up and then revealed again, the chimpanzee would have to remember which box they already have taken food from because there would no longer be food there. And so they used that as a way of measuring, like, how many boxes in would the chimpanzee remember its recent choices, which is another function of this working memory, remembering choices that you just made. And they found that the range was very similar to that of humans, that most of the chimpanzees, the ones that performed well, were able to remember four boxes. I think the best performing chimp was able to remember seven. So that, you know, 4 to 7 is in the human range of in terms of bits of information that for working memory.
That's so cool.
Yeah. But also they found that chimpanzees had the same, it wasn't just the sheer number, the same effects that we see in humans, they also demonstrated in chimpanzees. So if they were given a distracting task, it reduced their ability to remember how many boxes. So their working memory suffered when they were given other tasks. So that interference phenomenon existed for the chimpanzees as well. The chimpanzees used a combination of both spatial cues and the object features. So they would remember the boxes based, because if they could move the boxes around, right? So then they're not in the same place. The chimpanzees would still be able to remember based on the features of the box itself. But the children had essentially the same working memory as the chimpanzees, but they were able to engage in more sophisticated strategies that the chimpanzees didn't use. For example, some of the children hit upon the idea of going systematically, like from left to right, whereas the chimpanzees never hit upon that as a strategy. Mm-hmm. So the kids were smarter than the chimpanzees, but they're just raw processing power, if you will, in terms of their working memory was basically the same. Always, again, how similar we are to chimpanzees is endlessly fascinating. And, you know, there's always the antecedents to anything that we think is uniquely human. There's antecedents in the animal kingdom. And of course, chimpanzees are our closest cousins. So that's always the best place to look. Okay. This means that new research finds that artificial canned laughter decreased the degree to which subjects found comedy funny is the fiction. And Bob and Kara, you are correct. It increased the degree to which people found comedy funny. What they did, and this is being reported as the dad jokes. I don't know if you guys saw the reporting about this. But so they basically told people jokes that were not funny. Like, what's the best day to cook food?
Friday. Yeah.
Yeah. Good one.
Thank you, Evan.
What if you don't eat fried food, though?
Right. So that's exactly, those are the kind of jokes that they told. And then they did it without laughter. They did it with fake laughter, and then they did it with genuine laughter. Both the fake and the genuine laughter increased the degree to which the subjects rated the jokes as funny, but the genuine laughter had more of an effect. So there was a diminished effect from the artificial laughter, but it still made people laugh more and think they were funnier. It didn't have this opposite effect, this, you know, reverse effect. So that's a kind of makes sense. But yeah, even fake laughter, it still gives us the social cue that something is funny and we contagiously laugh. So good job, Bob and Kara.
Woo, Kara, high five.
All right, Evan, take us home with a quote.
Humans are pattern seekers. It's how we've always made sense of the world. Our ancestors wouldn't have survived if they hadn't realized that plants tend to flourish after rainfall or that saber-toothed tigers tended to eat them. But sometimes we're just a little too good at finding meaning in the noise, occasionally unable to separate real patterns from those of our own imagining. And that was written by Emma Gray Ellis. She is a journalist with Wired Magazine. And yep. She writes about science and planets and other interesting things. So check her out, Emma Gray Ellis.
I wouldn't say occasionally. I'd say all the time.
Oh,
it's like every day.
Occasionally all the time.
Yeah.
Heck yeah. We don't even know we're doing it.
Right. We are pattern seeking all the time. All right, guys. Well, thanks for joining me this week.
Sure, bro.
Thanks, Steve.
I didn't win science or fiction this week.
I know. That's all right, Jay.
I didn't either.
I sense a comeback in your near future.
Regression.
Statistically,
to the mean,
I'm
Jay.
Due.
Regression.
Yeah,
to
you're gonna regress to that mean, Jay. Don't worry about it.
Thank you.
Statistics are on your side. All right.
All right.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible. And remember that Cubico projects are designed to spark creativity, tinkering, and learning in kids of all ages. They make learning about science, technology, engineering, art, and math fun. They're on a mission to empower kids not just to make a project, but to make a difference. Cubico is offering the Skeptics Guide listeners the chance to try them for free. To redeem this offer and learn more about their projects for kids of all ages, visit kiwico.com/skeptics.